This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Our biggest source of inspiration has and continues to be Chess. You know, we watch the struggles he goes through, and I'm always amazed. I'm actually a big fan of boxing, and so the analogy that I like to use with Chaz is, you know, he's like that boxer that no matter how tough the fight is, he always answers the bell every single day. He wakes up, and he wakes up to a world that it's confusing, that he doesn't understand, that doesn't make a lot of sense to him, but every day he wakes up and he answers the bell. And I think that's what inspires Sarah and I.
There's no bigger champion. No bigger champion.
My name is Cindy Schumann. I am an assistant professor here in the Department of Psychiatry. I am a researcher here at the Mind Institute and director of the new Bears Tissue Program. I wanted to start with that video tonight just as a reminder of why it is that we are starting this program. The little boy there at the end with the face, that was my little brother-in-law, Chris. He's on the end there with his skateboard, too. So I came to UC Davis in 1999 to study autism before this beautiful building and everything else came about. And I came because I was inspired by the vision of the founding families to create a place to study autism like no other in the world, that had a very clear goal of finding treatments, prevention, and ultimately they wanted a cure. My first month that I was here, my little brother-in-law, Chris, he was 2 then, he was diagnosed with autism. And one of the many things that makes the Mind Institute unique is that we are reminded every day why we are here by the founding families, by the families that come into the clinic, our personal relationships, and our relationship with the community, that we have a clear assignment, that's not science for the sake of science, but that clearly we are here to find those treatments, preventions, and cures. I've watched Chris over 12 years. He's growing into a young man now as I've been doing autism research, and he's doing quite well. But he still struggles every day. I watched my mother-in-law struggle every day to find something, anything that will make their lives just a little bit easier. You know, this medication for this symptom and that medication or therapy or, you know, anything for that symptom, anything that can make things just a little bit easier for them. So it's still a struggle, even though he's now a freshman in high school and doing beautifully. But it's still a struggle, and it's hard. And, of course, he's 1 in 110 kids that have that struggle, 1 in 110 families who have that struggle every day. So that's why we're here. Of course, that's why the Mind Institute is here, but that's also why we are starting this program. As scientists, we need to understand how the brain is developing in order to get to those treatments and the prevention and ultimately cures. Autism is a behaviorally defined disorder, but it is a disorder of the brain. So we need to get to the biological basis of autism in order to meet those goals. We need to know how the brain is developing, when and why it might be deviating from that of typical development. What might be contributing to that? Is it genes? Is it the environment? Is it the immune system? What is it that's leading to that development or the brain developing differently? And how is it continuing to grow and change? Because it is continuing to grow and change even throughout lifetime. And so we need to get to those answers. We've made incredible strides in early behavioral intervention, especially here at the Mind Institute, probably one of the best places in the world for that. But still, every single day, a child is born with autism. Every single day, a new family hears for the first time that their child has autism. So we still need those answers. We also have incredible programs here at the Mind Institute. Maybe some of you have participated in the Autism Phenome Project, a wonderful program that has taught us that there may even be different forms of autism and that the brain is developing possibly differently in those different forms. And that's at the level of magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI. So how do we go from that to getting to that biological basis of autism? We need to know what's contributing to that growth. Is it at the level of the cells? Is it the number of neurons, for example, some of the work that we've done? Is it how the brain is developing at the molecular level, at the level of the genes? We need to get to that level in order to understand that biological basis. So I'm a neuroscientist. I've been doing research on the cellular basis of autism for the past 12 years, as has Dr. David Amaral, whom you'll hear from a little bit later on in the program. We published probably some of the first early studies of looking at the cellular basis of autism. And over the past 12 years, what we've seen is that there have been many new and established scientists coming into the field, neuroscientists, geneticists, immunologists, many different fields coming in and wanting to answer that same question, how to get to the biological basis of autism. But what they find, and are often shocked to find, is that there's no brain tissue to study. How can we get there if we don't have that brain tissue to study? So we decided that the Mind Institute was in a unique position to be able to change that course. We wanted to establish a program where we could increase awareness on the importance of brain donation and to get the tissue and get it to the scientists that need it. And brain endowment is a gift. It is a legacy to autism research, and it would make a huge difference in the progress toward our understanding of autism. Just to give you some perspective, less than 100 cases have ever been studied in the entire 50 years of autism research. And that is just pathetic. It really is ridiculous, and we can't make progress that way. But imagine even one donation, what 101 would mean to our progress. We want to do everything we possibly can with each one of those precious donations. So one of the other things that the founding family said is that they didn't care whether the treatments and cures came from here or they came from somewhere else in the world, but that the Mind Institute did everything that it possibly could. They expect us to do everything we possibly could to drive research forward. So we were founded on the principle of collaboration. And this program is also founded principle. We believe that progress can only be made if we foster collaboration, we work with organizations and institutions across the country and around the world, and to share that tissue. That's the only way that we can make progress, is to share that precious tissue and get it to as many different scientists and studies that we possibly can to get to those answers. So we asked you here today to help us shape this program. How is it that we can change the perception of brain donation? You're here because you're interested to find out. What can we do? You help us how we can shape this program to change perception, and then also what you can do to help us educate the community on the importance of brain donation. I'm a mom of two beautiful little girls. I don't want to think about it. No one does. But what can we do? Because it's clearly very important that we change that perception. We all probably don't think a thing about putting that little sticker on our driver's license that says, I'm an organ donor. We can see that clearly we can get from that organ donation to helping one person's life, probably saving one person's life. But what's more difficult to see is going from brain donation to helping many, many people's lives through the research that otherwise couldn't be done. So in a minute, you will have a chance to meet one family that did make that difficult decision to donate their son's brain when they lost him last January. We are honored to have Valerie Hund here and her family. Where they are, her husband Tony is here with her, and Grayson's little sister Vanessa, Tony's sister Mary, I knew I was going to do that, Mary, and Grayson's grandparents, Jerry and Marie. We are honored to have them here. You'll get a chance to hear from them, why it is that they made that decision, and what it's meant to them over the past year, and we are honored to have them. I have to say that Valerie is probably the most remarkable person I have ever met. And her strength has continued to inspire us. As scientists, we knew that we had to do this. We had to start this program in order to make progress. But what we didn't realize until we met Valerie and her family was that we had an obligation to do this and to do everything that we could to make this program succeed. So after Valerie, you'll hear from Chuck Gardner, one of our founding fathers of the Institute, and why it is that we conceived of the Institute, and about our goal of fostering collaboration and how this program fits with that goal. And then you'll hear from Dr. Amaral, our research director here at the Mind Institute, about what science can do. I think that a lot of us don't realize that we can do many, many different types of studies. We can do genetics and neuroscience and immunology, all of those different levels, powerful techniques that science has, only if we have the brain tissue to do it. And then finally, you'll hear from Dr. Len Abaduto, our director here at the Mind Institute, on how this program fits with the vision of the future of the Mind Institute. Before we get to that, I have another video to show you, because clearly my words aren't going to do it. We have a video of the program to show you, and then you'll have a chance to meet Valerie.
Grayson was a happy, joyful boy. He'd light up a room. Anytime you saw Grayson, always a smile. Grayson was a nonverbal autistic. Unfortunately, Grayson passed away from a seizure that he was never able to regain consciousness. So when we realized that Grayson would never regain consciousness and we were about to lose him, you know, as a parent, there's so much going through your head and trying to understand why, what happened, what went wrong, what could we have done differently. But the fact of the matter is we had lost Grayson, and we knew in that next 4 to 6 hours that there was a potential opportunity for donation. And as we were up all night grieving, we thought, what could we do? What could we do to make a difference? And we quickly contacted a friend that's associated with the Mind Institute, and he had us quickly connected with several of the scientists, and I believe by noon the next day we were on the phone going through the process of donation, and I can tell you that it helped us through the process of keeping our minds busy on Grayson's giving back. Grayson's, we're able to do something here through our tragedy, and everyone made it very comfortable for us too. It really brought us to a point where we knew that even though in our tragedy, Grayson lives on. And his ability to be a pioneer, perhaps, in looking at maybe not a cure, but maybe we can find that needle in the haystack and somebody can tell us with our contribution, we're making a difference.
Every brain that we receive allows us to do much more research on autism. Every brain is precious. This is a donation that will make a real difference in our understanding of the causes of autism.
Without the donation that Grayson's family gave, this research would not be possible. It is a rare and precious gift. It is a difficult decision to make, but it's so important for progress to be made.
Understanding the causes of autism will likely take several paths. A critically important one is probing the brains of individuals who had autism during life. Science now has incredibly powerful techniques to understand the pathology of the brain and to look into the genetics that might cause abnormal function. Yet this research is being stalled by the lack of appropriate brain material.
We know so little about how the brain is developing in a child with autism. We need to know what is happening at the cellular level, at the molecular level, what role genes are playing in how the brain is developing when it deviates from that of a typical child. This information is necessary for us to understand what is causing the disorder and how we can treat it. The goal of the BEARS program is to provide brain tissue to researchers not only here at the UC Davis Mind Institute, but to also share that tissue with scientists around the world. This program will allow research to be done that otherwise would not be possible.
The lack of autism brain tissue is a crisis in the field for research. And in terms of defining the neuropathology and the molecular events that occur in autism brain, that is actually true. We're at a bottleneck. We can't do certain kinds of research because we literally don't have the material to do that with. In fields like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, where there are thousands of brains available, or even schizophrenia, where hundreds and hundreds have been looked at, this has allowed for great advances in the molecular understanding of these disorders. And in autism, we're at a crisis because we can't actually do that work because of limitations of the tissue. It's not a money issue, it's not a personnel or know-how, it's literally we need to have the postmortem material to work with.
The Mind Institute is leading the way nationally and internationally as we look for cures and treatments for autism and other neurodevelopmental disorders. That's why we're very committed to the success of the BEARS program. We see the BEARS program as really providing missing critical data for translational research. The idea behind translational research is to move from basic science discoveries to new treatments, cures, and even strategies for prevention.
We've watched our son struggle every single minute of every single day. And it's our belief that the BEARS program will help us achieve the ultimate goal, which is a cure for autism. In addition to that, treatments for autism, but not only autism, other neurodevelopmental disorders, so that children no longer have to struggle throughout their entire lives.
So why did we make the decision to donate? It was simply said, why not? We knew that this could make a difference down the road to the research effort. And looking now, it's been 8 months, almost 9 months. We want to stay in tune in the world of autism. It was so much part of our lives. And being able to stay in touch and being able to contribute is just almost our duty as a parent. We continue to stay in touch with other families that have children with autism, and so it just seemed to be the right thing.
Everyone can do something to help. You can educate your friends and family about the importance of this program and encourage them to go onto our website and register to become a brain donor.
I think that parents of kids with autism, I mean, you see the struggle that your kid goes through every day, and to know that you can contribute to a future that could possibly be without those struggles for other kids, I think is... It's a responsibility that I think most parents who have a kid with autism believe that they have to uphold.
If other parents ever were in this situation, should they call the Mind Institute? I say yes. Please do. It's something that all of us can work together at getting one step closer to finding maybe just one more piece of information to get the clue.
It's heartbreaking when you talk with another parent and they say, oh, you know, I know you have a child with autism. My daughter was just diagnosed with autism. Or I have a nephew who was just diagnosed with autism. Because the first thing you want to do is wrap your arms around them and say, I am so sorry. One day we'll be able to say, you know what, there's a treatment for that. And it's because of the Bears program. You'll get there with help from the Bears program.
We owe it to them to do everything we can to understand the disorder that their child suffered from. Every donation will make a drastic difference in our understanding of the causes of autism in order to develop biological treatments for children and adults living with the disorder and ultimately to find cures.
When Cindy asked us to share our perspective as to why we donated, we thought this would be something we would be honored to do. Her request fits so well with the energy we've had very willingly spent these past several years in behalf of autism. As you just learned from watching the video, there were many reasons we made the decision. But simply put, why not? It's been a year since we were faced with the biggest tragedy of our lives and of our family, when time seemed to stand still and all we could think was how this could have happened. Our healthy, thriving 16-year-old boy who adored life and especially food that exuded love and happiness was no longer on earth and had slipped away from us. Every parent's nightmare, to say the least, is one we hope and pray none of you will ever experience. Our lives as we once knew it was suddenly to be forever changed. In the hours after Grayson's passing, Tony and I were faced with a decision: should we donate? Did the advantages more than outweigh the sacrifices? This is obviously isn't a typical conversation topic parents have or plan on deciding ahead of time. But immediately Tony asked, shouldn't we reach out to the Mind Institute? To this day, I'm so thankful he asked. It was the easiest decision for us to make in the midst of our tragedy. With the help of Cindy and Eric Everson, we were quickly connected to the Mind Institute, the Mind Institute's neuroscientist, Cindy Schumann. Quickly, we had to undergo the process, for time was of the essence. After several phone calls and signed paperwork, Grayson was a donor, all in less than 24 hours of his passing. We didn't know then what we know now of how rare brain tissue donation is. Given the fact over the past 3 decades, fewer than 100 donations have been made, reconfirms our decision, why not, was the right decision. Knowing the increase in children diagnosed with autism at an alarming rate of 1 in 110, when Grayson was diagnosed at the age of 3, it was 1 in every 950. We've been asked, would it have been easier to have Grayson as a registered donor ahead of time? And obviously the answer is yes. It would have been a quicker process and enabled us to handle one less task and the myriad of tasks that parents never expect to face. Oftentimes, out of something bad comes something good. Knowing Grayson is able to contribute to autism research, or at a minimum, increase more visibility to the mystery of autism, has helped us through our grief. Grayson's other contribution has been his memorial scholarship that we just set up at Las Positas Community College in Livermore. It's eligible to any college student pursuing special education or a college student that's on the autism spectrum. We knew that his legacy must live on, for Grayson was not only special, he still had a lot to contribute that must carry on. As mentioned earlier, our lives have forever changed. The family dynamics were always centered on caring for Grayson, always a set of eyes watching out for him and guiding him along to ensure he was always safe. Tony and I and our daughters, Ashley and Vanessa, might not be faced with the daily journey of caring for a loved one with autism, but our hope is we stay closely connected in the next phase with the Bears program and the invaluable research by the Mind Institute. We were given the privilege to have Grayson as our very own. Although for a very short time, our next journey is to help raise awareness of how much is needed to take us one step further to finding the causes of autism. How fitting that Grayson's favorite movie quote is, "To infinity and beyond." Thank you to the Mine Institute for all their support and allowing us to be part of the Bears program. Thank you.
Valerie, thank you. Your story hits really close to home. You know, our son's 19, and he has seizures, and there's been times when we've had to go pick him up off the sidewalk, and he wasn't doing so well. So your story really hits home, so thank you. I appreciate that Cindy and David gave me 5 minutes to tell the history of the Mine Institute. I guess they're getting me back for giving them 10 years of Cure Autism, so fair is fair. They said, you know, Cindy sends me an email, and could you have any slides or anything? I hate PowerPoint. I live and breathe PowerPoint every day in my real job, and so I said, no. She said, could you just send a photo or something? And so I went through the 6,128 photos on iPhoto, and I came up with this one. And it was taken a couple years ago, and so it's maybe a real quick way to tell the story of the Mine Institute through this photo. And that photo was taken at Disneyland. As you know, the happiest place on Earth, particularly the happiest place on Earth for Chas, even at 19. He's always had an affection from the day he was born with watching Disney sing-alongs. So even today, I can quote you line and verse of every single one of those, and so can the people who care for him. But years before this photo was taken, we were at Disneyland right after he had been diagnosed with autism. And you guys, some of you may remember, there was an organization that eventually merged into Autism Speaks. It was Cure Autism Now. And so I had a shirt on that was the Cure Autism Now shirt. And we were over in the Roger Rabbit section of Disneyland. And a mom walked up to me, and she was upset and said, you know, I have a four-year-old son that has autism, and how dare you think that you can cure autism? Who are you to be telling people to have false hope that there's some way to cure this disease that affects my son? I was really taken back by that because then, as I do now, even at 19, I believe that there's hope and there's a cure for our son. But I'd say that the thing that really struck me the most is this mom with a very young son somehow had already come to believe that her son had fallen outside the bounds of hope. And so the reason that we really created this place was that no kid should be beyond the bounds of hope. And that's how we founded this place, and I think that's what still resides here today. I also think that you can't have hope unless you also have a great deal of trust. And I don't know that we thought about that at first, but as Chas gets older, Sarah and I, we still hold on to that chance that there's this needle in a haystack, a silver bullet that will come along and provide some meaningful treatment or even a cure for his autism. But if it doesn't, you know, we understand the risk associated with carrying hope with you. But for us, you know, we believe that his legacy, like yours, Valerie, that it'll live on and be passed on to future generations. So his life will have meaning regardless of whether there's a cure that comes in time for him or not. But the one thing that I thought a lot about, especially when I heard your story, is, you know, the reason I think that Sarah and I hold on to the hope for our son is we have a lot of trust in these guys, in this institute that's been built here. And so I just say that, you know, when I heard your story, the one thing that just kind of struck me is the incredible amount of trust that you've placed in this team and this institute. And so we built originally a house of hope, but I think it's also become a guardian of our trust as parents. So thank you, and thank you guys.
And I first want to thank Valerie and Tony and your family for your courage and your donation. It really, I think, will start. You know, there's always, you know, the first step, and I think this is the first step of what's going to be an incredible enterprise. Chuck, I'm always inspired by Chuck, and thank you for being here tonight, Chuck. I want to introduce one other couple, too, Michelle and David Lewing, who are here in the front. Just raise your hand. Michelle is and David, new friends to the Mind Institute, and Michelle has really helped enormously with the early stages of thinking through the BEARS program. In fact, BEARS is the creation of Michelle. So we appreciate that creative effort. You know, we appreciated a long time ago that, you know, scientists don't think all that creatively about public relations and things like that. And we need to really go out to the community to get our inspiration. And Michelle has already been a tremendous help, and we look forward to much more help. And last but not least, I think I have to say that when I see Cindy leading this program, which, as she said, she was a graduate student here a long time ago, and she was a graduate student in my lab, and I really do take tremendous pride in seeing her now matured as an independent scientist and leading with her passion and with her dedication, leading an effort that really, really is hard, but she's doing it with such grace and finesse that I'm just delighted to see it. So I want to thank you. Here's the question: Why do we need brains? And you know, I think it's pretty clear that the human brain is an incredible organ. You know, you probably all know that it has at least 100 billion neurons, the things that that make the brain work. Even more incredible is that there's 100 trillion synapses, the connections between all those brains. And, you know, so what does the brain do? And I like this quote because it's almost 2,500 years old. This is from Hippocrates, you know, the Hippocratic Oath. He says, "From the brain and from the brain only arise our pleasures, joy, laughter, and jests, as well as our sorrows, pain, griefs, and tears." And so the brain is a miraculous organ that allows us to do what makes us human. And when problems with the brain happen, that leads to disorders like autism, like schizophrenia, like other diseases that we're trying to deal with. And so when we as scientists try and understand the brain, we have to go at various levels, from the genes that control the development of the brain, to the cells of the brain, to circuits, and then ultimately to the behavior of individuals and to people who have problems. And I just wanted to give you a couple of examples of why it is so essential that we have brain material to understand autism. Just let me give you a couple of examples from the gene level. Now, autism is a highly genetic disorder. We think that there's other things going on, but it's clear that it's a highly genetic disorder. And there has been enormous amount of progress made on understanding the genes that control the brain. And so this paper just came out last year. It has the title, "Somatic Retrotransposition Alters the Genetic Landscape of the Human Brain." So I'm not a geneticist, but the bottom line is, what does this mean? What it means is that DNA related to function and disease is different in the brain than in the blood or other tissues. So we used to think that the DNA that was in all your cells is basically the same, that if you took some skin cells, it would be the same thing as brain cells. Turns out that's wrong. The DNA in brain cells is actually different than the DNA in blood cells and in other cells in your body. So if there's a genetic problem in autism, which we think there is, it is going to be ultimately essential for us to look at brain cells, at brain tissue. An example of this is actually in the movie that we saw. There was Dan Geschwin, who's a colleague from UCLA. He and his colleagues just did an incredible study. It took them 5 years to get enough bits and pieces of a postmortem brain to carry out this study. But they found The title is basically the punchline, that transcriptomic analysis of autistic brain reveals convergent molecular pathology. And again, what does that mean? It means that the DNA that regulates how the brain develops and how it differentiates in all its different parts and all its different connections is abnormal in autism. And again, the point of his paper is that you would never see these abnormalities if you looked at blood cells or skin cells. You have to look at brain cells. So the problem here is that the genes in the brain that allow the front of the brain, the frontal lobe, to be different from the temporal lobe and to do its different functions don't seem to be working properly in autism. And again, you wouldn't know that unless you looked at the brain of individuals with autism. So again, I could go on and tell you, but basically the bottom line is that, as Dan Geschwin said, we'll never understand the genetics of autism unless we have some brain material to study. And take it up a level to cells and circuits. And here I'm not going to talk about particular papers, but I just wanted to say that we can actually look at the brain of living individuals with autism, and we do that all the time. We actually have a big program here where we're looking at the brain of children and trying to figure out what's going wrong with its development. And one of the things that goes wrong is that if you chart how the brain matures over time, the growth curve of the brain, what you find is what's shown in this diagram. And I'll just tell you the punchline here. You see how the yellow curve goes above the line early on? That here's the yellow curve of brain development for children with autism based on a large number of studies. What that says is that the brain of some children with autism grows too fast early on. So at about between 0 and 3 years of age, for reasons that we don't understand, the brain of some children with autism just sort of goes off the curve and grows too rapidly. And we think that that's bad because it's not all parts of the brain that's growing too rapidly, it's particular parts of the brain. And the brain development is like a symphony. Everything has to be working in tune. If it doesn't, connections don't get made properly, and then you don't have normal function. So sometimes you can actually see the differences. This is a study that one of our scientists, Christine Nordel, has done. And this is a normal brain here, and this is one from a child that she imaged that has regressive autism. And you can tell that this brain is bigger, right? This one is not so clearly bigger. But this is about as far as we can go with MRI. And the problem is, here's a picture of an MRI of a child. You can see this child, the nose is here, and there's the brain inside. But if you actually take just one little tiny cube out of this brain, and you ask, well, what's in that? There's 50,000 neurons. There's 100 to 300 million synapses, and we cannot see that with an MRI. The MRI is just too crude to be able to see that. And even if you go down another level and you start looking inside the brain, this is an animation of what the interior of the brain looks like. The little dots of light are neurons that are firing what are called action potentials. That's how they communicate one neuron to the other. But this is what the real brain looks like. It's an incredibly complicated jungle of axons and dendrites and everything else. We can't see this at the MRI level. Let me go even a little bit further down in higher magnification so we can look at a little bit. And this actually has background music. It's pretty cool, huh? This is actually a beautiful picture of 1 cubic millimeter of the brain. This is, it turns out to be of a rat, but the human brain would look the same. This is done by colleagues at Stanford University. And the point is that every one of these red dots is a synapse. Every one of these blue lines is the input side to a neuron, and the green lines are the output side. This is just one teeny tiny little cue that we can look at, whether it's a rat brain or whether it's a human brain. It's easy to do that. And we think that actually that's a little bit too loud. That's better. So we think that actually for disorders like autism, like schizophrenia, like some of these other disorders, maybe the secret will not be sort of
that the brain is too big. But why is it too big? We actually think it's the interaction between all of these neurons that I'm showing you here, how they communicate to each other. And the bottom line is that we just can't see that with the MRI. We have to look at postmortem brain material. And so we really think that unless we can go to this level, the real secrets underlying what causes autism are just going to remain secrets. And we can't let that happen. And again, this is why this program is so important. We really want to get to the root causes of autism so we can do something about it. So with that, I'll just say, this is a team effort. We can solve the problem of autism. We can understand the mysteries. But we need these donations, and this is why it is so important what Cindy and Valerie and our whole team is doing together. So we appreciate you being here and lending your support to this effort.
It's really a pleasure to be here tonight, and it's a privilege to do the work, be a part of the work that we do. I can't put into words our gratitude to Valerie and her family, and so I won't even try to do that, but I will thank them for being here tonight. Thank you to Chuck for being here tonight and for all of his support and his vision when he was one of our founding families, and it's wonderful that we stay connected to our families. I also want to mention we do have one of our other founding fathers here, Dr. Lou Vismaro. Lou, can you just stand up? And so Lou remains very active and is chair of our board now, and it's a pleasure to work with him and a privilege. And also, I just want to echo really quickly how proud I am of Cindy. I see her running around the halls every day doing something related to the Bears program, and her commitment to the program and to the families is really inspiring, and it's a pleasure to have her as a colleague. I was at the University of Wisconsin, the Waisman Center, for 24 years before I came here in August, and the Waisman Center is a distinguished research center focused on neurodevelopmental disorders. Before that, I was at the Vanderbilt Kennedy Center for 5 years, and that also is a research center focused on neurodevelopmental disorders. But I have to say, there is no place like the Mind Institute, and it is because it was founded by families, and the commitment to families is palpable here, and it really is what makes this special, and it drives every single individual here in ways that I've not seen elsewhere. And so, again, it's a privilege to do the work that we do on behalf of families, and so this is why I'm so committed to this program. So I want to make a few comments. The Mind Institute is committed to this concept of translational research. And at the Mind Institute, we always have grand plans. And our concept of translational research, I think, is bigger than we see at other places. And kind of the analogy to understand translational research is this notion of bench to bedside to curbside. And so what that really means is what we want to do from the bench is to take basic science findings, and we want to turn them into treatments, strategies for preventions and cures. And so that's the bedside. That's getting to the patient. But the curbside is the kind of the next level. So it's not enough that we just develop these potential treatments. We want them to be widely available. We want to impact not just one child and one family. We want to impact all children and all families and have a truly dramatic impact on our world and on families affected by neurodevelopmental disorders. And so I think that that's a big challenge, but I think, again, if anyone can achieve it, I think it is the scientists of the Mind Institute. And this is a slide that is impossible to read. And so the only reason I put this up, this is from a paper that was published in Science in 2008. And what they did, and this is really kind of interesting, it basically tried to say, well, translational science is a hard road to hoe, but can we quantify that in some way? And what they did is they basically looked at, for a variety of physical symptoms, not necessarily neurodevelopmental disorders, but physical symptoms and conditions, they tried to look at publications to figure out when a treatment or a cure was first suggested and then how long it took to actually have it widely available at the curbside, if you will. And at the top, what we see are many failed treatments, things that were promising, that were worked on for years, that failed. On the bottom part, what they show are things that actually came to fruition, things that actually ended up being treatments that were successful and that were widely available and widely used. And how long did that take? The median, 24 years. to go from the first hint of something that's a treatment to actually having something successful. And you can forget the things that didn't work and all the wasted effort. So the translational science is a long process. And if you think about that from the perspective of a family, and I get to work with families every day in my research, or I visit them in the clinics, and I don't ever want to have to say to a family, come back in 24 years and maybe we'll have an answer for you. That's really not acceptable to me, and not acceptable to anyone at the Mind Institute. So what do we do about it? I think there are really two things that we are doing about it here at the Mind Institute. The first thing is we have to help families now. Before we have the ultimate cure, we need to do things. And so we have clinics that are tremendous clinics for doing diagnostic services and providing treatments. We have wonderful research that's looking at possible pharmaceutical treatments that may alleviate some of the symptoms of autism or other neurodevelopmental disorders, and we're offering that to families. We have scientists who are working on innovative behavioral treatments. Sally Rogers and Lori Vismar have a wonderful program, the Early Start Denver model, that is a comprehensive program that helps children and families now. So that's one thing that we're doing, and we have to do that because we can't have families wait. We have to offer them services and some relief and support now. But the other thing that we have to do is kind of obvious to everyone. Let's shorten that period. We can't make this a 24-year effort. And again, 24 years is on the average, right? We have to shorten that. In the case of autism, right now, the one thing that we can do, that we know we can do to shorten that time frame, is to have more brain tissue. We know that that is just an unacceptable situation, and it is slowing progress. I mean, Dan Geschwin in the film said it beautifully. We know what to do. We have the people to do it. We have resources to do it, but we don't have the material that's needed. And so that's why I'm really committed to this program. And the other thing that I want to just say, again, something that makes the Mind Institute special, we are not territorial in the sense of we want to lead the way because we feel it's our responsibility. But this is not about just accelerating research at the Mind Institute. This tissue will be available to scientists around the world. And Cindy and David have worked out a plan that we know we can do that. And so this is about being a game changer. This is about changing in a serious way and accelerating progress in our understanding of autism by getting tissue to all of the scientists. And that's what we should be doing here at the Mind Institute. This is not about us. This is about the families. And so this is a great program. This fits with our vision, and we are incredibly committed to it. And that's why, again, I can't even put into words how thankful we are to the Hunt family, not only for their donation, but for their inspiration. And it really motivates us every day. So thank you very much.
Okay, so the question is rapid early brain development, like rapidly building a house and then having to go back and retrofit plumbing and wiring? Is it a genetic error, a new neurochem lack or overabundance, a toxic explosive?
Exploder. Sorry.
Exploder. is food or water
testing,
an environmental exposure, a fetal maternal stress? I guess those are
possible.
Are those any of the...
So the question is, what is it?
So there's a couple of answers. One is that, first of all, not all children with autism have a rapidly growing brain. That was one of the things that scientists here at the Mind Institute were able to discover. Now, what causes the rapidly growing brain, that's still a mystery. And I think it actually may be all of the above. So there may be genetic influences, but what we know is that the genetics of autism are incredibly complicated, and you know there's now 150 different genes that put people at risk for having autism, none of which actually really commit you to autism. So there's lots of things going on. We actually have some preliminary data that it may be actually something related to the maternal environment during gestation that may be going on as well. So, you know, we're really trying to figure this out. But again, as I mentioned, you know, we have the fact that there's a big brain. And, you know, we are at a loss now to try and go further into figuring out. We don't even know whether it's more neurons or whether there's an inflammatory process going on and it's swelled, you know, just as if you had an inflammatory process. So we're really sort of stymied to try and figure that out. unless we can actually start looking at some brain material. There is evidence that there's almost an infectious process going on in a subset of brains with autism, but not all. And we just need to look at more brains in order to be able to figure that out. But it's a terrific question.
So I did notice that the paper that you have for people to sign if they would like does cover some different areas, not just autism. You have a lot of different check boxes. So I'm assuming you want all different areas plus normal brains as
absolutely.
Well?
Absolutely, and that's
what
extremely
typically
important.
Developing or non-diagnosed. Can you dispel some of the mystery for me and maybe for others? What happens when you sign, say, I would sign for my son, who's a dependent, and he passes away. What happens from that point? Just to dispel some of the mystery.
No, that's a wonderful question. So for when we ask you to register to become a brain donor, that means that you have thought about the process, you're able to get the information, and hopefully what you will do first of all is inform your family and your friends about your desire to do that, what your wishes are. At that point, we would actually need the family to contact us. That's how we would find out about it. And there is additional process to that. So it's not that it's a done deal, you know, at by any means. And so from there, and you know, Valerie could probably talk to you about that more, but we spent, you know, quite a bit of time together that first day, and every situation is different. And so we need to, you know, we need to be flexible. We need to do what we can to go through the process. And once we, you know, sign those papers and sign the consent, and then from there we carry out the process of donation.
I guess my question is related to, it was mentioned earlier that when we get our California driver's license, we mark the box that we want to donate. Is there a way for your program to tie in through there where people can, you know, indicate that they want research versus other parts or other ways of donations? Because I could see that as a very clear resource to tie these two programs together.
Right.
I don't know if that's already been done.
Yes. I mean, it's an excellent point, and that's something that we would really need to do. I don't know if Lou, you want to comment. Lou has been behind that idea for a while now, and hoping that.
Right now, the state is strapped, but I think it's a great idea, and perhaps using, you know, again, some type of internet-based registry. We've also had conversations on a preliminary basis about establishing a voluntary statewide registry that, again, could, which this could be an important component, to also provide a linkage for a variety of other evaluations, interventions, and procedures. So I think it's a great idea. And actually, Dr. Amaral and Dr. Abadudu have had some preliminary conversations with us about perhaps implementing such a voluntary registry.
But I think that, I mean, your point is that's really what we need to get to in order to get to the numbers that we need. And it is extremely important that we have those typical or non-autism, non-disorder cases, because as David was saying, you look at a brain, you can't really tell, oh, that person had autism. I mean, it just doesn't happen. So we have to be able to compare it to something. And the only way that we can do that is if we get the brain tissue from typical or non-disorder cases. And so to get it out there into the numbers that we need to, that's the ultimate goal.
So just to kind of give you some ideas of, we'd really like to that you could take away a call to action for you to help us. You could register to be a donor. We talked about that and going on to our website. The website has a lot of information, and inform others about the importance of brain tissue donation and trying to change that perception, and encourage others to also go on to the website and register to be a brain donor. You can volunteer for outreach and education. We have many events, and that we would really appreciate, especially as parents and family members and friends, that you can reach out to the community and help us get the message out of the importance of brain donation. And, of course, supporting us with the financial contribution is always definitely welcome and helpful as well. So thank you very much, and I appreciate you coming tonight.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.